presents this, we have a number of keynote sessions in year two this week, presented by some of our research and further institutes. So we have first now, so Professor Clifford will be talking about particle physics and the Large Hadron Collider. So the Clifford is Canadian, so he was born in Manitoba. Did his PhD at the University of Texas at Austin with Peter Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize for particle physics and is credited with coining the term standard model. So very extremely well known. He's worked in many, many places, including Princeton, McGill, a university, and currently is a professor at Master University just down the road in Hamilton, and also an associate researcher here at Trimble Institute. Has certainly a broad range of interests. He gives us everything from cosmology, string cosmology, particle physics, and probably a bunch of other things I'm not mentioning. He's won many awards, too many to be mentioned, but one of the most recent ones is last year the Association Award for theoretical physics. He's also one of our outreach superstars at Trimble, and does a lot of outreach, he's very passionate, and does a great job of always communicating physics to students, teachers, to the public, giving many, many talks. So you may recognize him from some of his roles in educational videos, and GPS and more things. So also, he has a great talk on string theory, and is the only research right now that can actually explain string theory by the
Here to Professor Cliff Burgess.
It's great. Thanks for letting me. I love doing these Einstein Plus things, and mostly because I love hearing the introduction. Calm down now. I got to introduce you to my mom. I'm here to talk about, talk about the Large Hadron Collider, which is it's on and it's running and they're really pumped. I was just a couple weeks ago was in CERN and it's just got this sense when you're there that it's rumor after rumor that they've seen this, haven't seen this, and so it's all very, very, it's a very exciting time in particle physics, and that's the main thing I want to get across, is that this is really a game-changing experiment that is likely going to change the way we think about particle physics. So the subtitle is Start of a New Era, is the game-changing thing. Or end of the world is the end of the world is what you probably also heard of the Large Hadron Collider. If you Google it, it's mostly the sites you get are talking about how it's going to destroy the Earth. And that was more of a worry before they turned it on and it didn't destroy the Earth. But there's lots of predictions being made as to what you could see. And so this picture here is a picture of the CMS detector, one of the big detectors at the LHC before it was finished being built. So you can see the parts of the inside of it. And I put it up there because everybody who's in this frothing atmosphere at CERN is making predictions as to what they'll see. And I was trying to find a picture that would get across predictions of what they would see. And the end of the world thing does that. So this slide is actually taken from the web. And the subtext here, you can't see, the Lobus Large Hadron Collider says, this is one of the first predictions. It says, it's going to fucking kill you dead. So most predictions will be wrong. The first ones. But the picture was that it was going to destroy the world. So you don't need much of a detector for that, it turns out. So most of what they're talking about is this thing was built to see. The short version of the whole talk is that there's this really great theory of particle physics, which when you put it together with general relativity, has described for 30 years or more all the experiments that have been done. And what's happened over the last, say, 10, 15 years is that there's a couple of things that are starting to fail in that theory. And the theory itself seems like it's going to break down. It's describing the constituents and the interactions of nature at the smallest scales. And the smallest scales that we have access to are the ones that it applies down to. But the theory itself seems to say that if you go a little bit farther down in distance scale, it's going to fail. And this machine was designed more or less 30 years ago to probe those scales where this theory is going to fail. And so you'll find out what's going to happen, what's going on at a deeper level that will really replace the standard model, which is this theory that works really well. So I'd like to tell you first about the machine, what it is. Give you the context. You also heard that when you turned it on, it broke. And so what broke? And that's actually constrained to what they're doing now, and their research program has been curtailed a little bit. And so I'll tell you in what way. And then the motivation, what it was trying to fix. I'll just remind you about the standard model and why we believe it works so well in the first place, and then what the limitations were to it and what made it seem like it was going to break down. And then what I hope that you'll get from the second part will be there's a lot of proposals out there for these predictions that people have made as to what they should see that will replace the standard model. And no one knows which is the right one. I have my favorites. Mm-hmm. But what's probably fair to say is that they all fall into three broad categories of theories. And it's probably going to be, I'd say it's very likely to be true that what they find will be in one of these three, or maybe two of these three categories. And the categories are motivated by the problems that the standard model has. So by the time we get to this point, you'll see what the problems are, and that will motivate these three categories. So I'll kind of tell you what the categories are and then tell you where we are now. And the short version of where we are now is that they expect to, in this year, have something interesting, where the worst case scenario might just be that they see that the standard model is working and they'll find the remaining things that haven't been found in the standard model yet. But there should be something that happens in the next year. And then they're going to shut down for a year to fix some problems, and then they'll start up again, and that's when it probably will get really interesting. So what's the machine? The machine is, it's a big 27-kilometer circumference ring in which there's an evacuated tube. Protons are sent in both directions around this ring, and they miss each other for the most part because they're very little narrow beams. But in various places, they're brought together to collide, and they produce particles, and you see what comes out. And so the two things are the accelerator, which is driving these protons and giving them the enormous speeds they have, and the detectors, which are seeing what comes out. So start with the accelerator. So this is where it is. This is that's kind of Lake Geneva here. So this is the Swiss-French border, kind of runs along like this, cuts through the ring, and then it kind of goes off here, and then comes back again. And then this is all in France. This is Mont Blanc in the distance. And so it's you can see why people like to go there, right? It's really, there's a kind of a small range of mountains. The Jura Mountains are kind of running along here, and you're in a broad valley. And the city of Geneva is kind of right there, and that's the stripe is the airport. And CERN, the lab that you're going to show you in a second, is kind of right around there. And so that the scale is, you can walk from CERN to the waterfront in about an hour and a half. So it's not a very big city. It's very pleasant. And the lab straddles the border, so that you've got a gate in France and a gate in Switzerland. And so you can see this from space. It's 27 kilometers is the circumference of that thing. And of course, you can't really see it from space because it's underground. So actually, you could have seen it from space if it had been on the ground. So here's the here it is here, and then this is kind of a showing you. This is, you're looking down along the valley. These are the Jura Mountains that were below us in that previous picture, and here are the big Alps over here, and here's Geneva. And there's a variety of places where these protons are brought together to collide, and those are where these detectors are. And there's four main ones, and the two multi-purpose ones are ATLAS and CMS. That CMS is the one for which I had the picture on the first slide. And then there's two more specialized ones, LHCb and ALIS, that are aimed at kind of more specific kinds of physics. This little circle here is they start the protons off in a smaller accelerator, and then they inject it into the big one. This is the LHC. This is the main ring in the LHC. And this stuff over here, ATLAS and this older accelerator, are underneath the actual lab site for CERN, whereas the CMS is kind of on the other side of the ring. So it's kind of a 20-minute drive from CERN. So you can kind of see that it's a very... This is a picture of the tube. And what that says is it's a big magnet, and inside the magnet is a vacuum tube where they pump out all the air, so the protons don't hit things. And the magnets are there, of course, because these are protons, you want to go in a circle, and you have to have something which bends the direction. And I'm telling you about the magnets a lot because that's what broke when they turned it on. And these things are huge. So they're very large, and of course they have to be put down this hole. They have to be lowered down this hole from the top into the ring, and then they're driven around this 27-kilometer thing in a trolley at like 3 kilometers an hour. And apparently one of the hazards is the people that are driving the trolley fall asleep because it just takes forever to go around this ring. Not a lot of things going on there. And so it's the scale of it is just enormous. It's really a huge, huge accelerator. And if you saw the movie Angels and Demons, you know that was actually started in CERN. I'm going to start off with some of the things about the movie because they actually start off actually in CERN at the Atlas detector. So this picture, this building behind them is kind of one of the landmarks at CERN, which you can kind of see. Here's the lab at CERN, and that round thing there is what they're standing in front of. That's this brown thing. And the Swiss-French border kind of comes along like that, cuts through CERN, and then runs along the fence here, and then it goes along like that, along that road. And the Atlas detector is beneath this building here. And there used to be a border crossing right there between that you had to go through customs. But now it's a Schengen border, so now as of 2 years ago, there's no border police. And so and all the theorists live here, and then the cafeteria is here, which is where all the coffee is, and that's where most people spend their time. This is where the experimentalists, this is their experimental office building. And the detectors I'm going to show you are about the same size as this office building. So it gives you a nice, it's like 4 stories high. It's like the west block of the Parliament building, if you like. And the tunnel, the shaft that goes down to the tunnel where this thing is like the Peace Tower. So that's the scale you're talking about. So here's the opening shot of the movie where they zoom down into this shaft down into where the detector is. And I don't know how many people saw this movie, Angels and Demons. It's better than the book. It's kind of cool with you. This is a picture of the same shaft. They actually shot this thing right at CERN. So the first part starts off quite accurate. So this is a picture I took looking down from the building in the Atlas, and this is the Atlas detector when it was still under construction at the bottom of that shaft. So this is the thing that's about the height of the Peace Tower you're looking down at. And the detector at the bottom there is this 4-story size building. And so then this is the movie scene. They go down there, they're next to the detector, and the next detector in the movie there is a control room, and they're all bald and wearing lab coats, and that's because they're supposed to be physicists. This is what it really looks like. The control room is actually not anywhere near the collider because it's dangerous to be down there when it's running. There's radioactivity, and so no one's down next to the detector. There's not a big glass wall or anything. It's just a concrete wall. But the control stuff is all on the surface. It's all done by computer, and there's not a lab coat in sight, as you can see. It's supposed to be a bunch of ordinary people that are a lot of bad hair, maybe. So then the movie starts and they collide these particles and they're easy to see because they glow in the dark. And it doesn't work like that either, it's all invisible. But the biggest mistake they made was that they turned it on in the movie and it worked. What really happened was they turned it on and it broke. So what happened when it broke? This is kind of a picture of the damage that happened when it broke. So there's these magnets that you saw, and they're kind of bolted down into the concrete. And so what happened was that when the accident happened, a couple of these magnets were kind of pulled off their moorings and moved over and dropped again. And of course they're all linked together, so that took the next one off, the next one off, the next one off. And so a lot of force was exerted, and you can see why in a second. So they, besides being damaged due to the actual moving things around, a whole bunch of crap went down this vacuum tube. And so this is supposed to be copper, and normally when you look down the vacuum tube, this is a shot down the vacuum tube, it's normally all pink, and so all this gray stuff is the crap that went down the vacuum tube, so they had to clean all that out, because you have to have a very good vacuum, otherwise these protons don't make it around the ring. And the accident in this picture where Janine was over there, and the lab was over there, the accident was over here, and it's probably, this is the Jura Mountains again. When they built the ring, there was a seepage problem, that water kind of came in there, so it might have been related to why they had the problem there mostly, what actually broke was the connections between these magnets. So here's a bunch of the magnets before they put them down into the ring. And there's thousands of these magnets, and they all have to be connected to one another. And this is a typical connection. You see there's lots of things that have to be connected. But in particular, the important thing about these magnets is that the magnets, to be strong enough to make the protons curve enough, given that the energy the protons have to be superconducting magnets. So they're being driven by a current which has no resistance because it's moving through a superconductor. But it's a superconductor only if it's cooled to liquid helium temperatures, which are, you know, 1.something Kelvin. And so the whole 27 kilometer ring is at 1.7 or something Kelvin, or 2.7 Kelvin, some few Kelvin temperatures. And so the problems happen, and what happened in this particular case, when if for some reason one of these magnets heats up past the boiling point of helium, then what happens is that it's no longer superconducting. So then all of a sudden it will start to resist, and the energy that due to that's being dissipated by that resistance has to go somewhere, and that's kind of what moved these magnets around. So what happened, of course, they're prepared for that to happen. They, every once in a while, that's called a quench, when a superconducting magnet is no longer superconducting. And they design this thing to handle that. And so the way they do that is that they have this basically a wire, which is a superconducting wire, 27 kilometers long. And the insulator for that wire is actually copper, which is what you would have normally made a wire out of in a regular wire. And it's copper because from the point of view of a superconductor, that's actually insulating. And so the current, well, it's not going to the copper normally. But if the superconducting wire stops superconducting, then the copper will carry the current. And so it'll actually carry it off someplace where it won't do any damage. So that's the concept anyway. So what happened was they, in retrospect, found that some of these welds where they're welding this copper insulator together between the two magnets had bad welds in them. And so it was resisting more than it was supposed to. And that's not a problem as long as things are working. So in this cartoon, you're imagining that this red thing is the superconducting current, and this red line in it is the current traveling along the superconductor. And the copper bars are there, and they're not carrying any current unless the superconducting current gets broken. And then these are the welds. This is where the joins are. So as long as the current is in the superconducting part, you don't care how good the weld is here. But as soon as, you know, what's supposed to happen is that if you, for some reason, the temperature rises and that they don't superconduct, the current moves into the copper, but then you do care how good these welds are. And so what happened was they had bad welds. And so when the first magnet stopped superconducting that had a bad weld, the current tried to go down the copper, and then it hit this big resistance that it wasn't supposed to hit. And that was the thing that they hadn't anticipated, and that's what made the accident worse than they had expected. So they've been fixing it. So they've been replacing many of the magnets. They had to replace 14 of these magnets. There's two kinds of magnets. There's the dipoles and quadrupoles, and so they've replaced 14 of the quadrupoles and 29 of the dipoles. But the thing is that they didn't. You know, once they had realized there was a problem, they fixed the ones that actually broke. They had to go back and think about, are there more welds like this in the rest of the ring that they haven't figured out? And so you would have thought the conservative thing to do, and they're Swiss, so they're conservative, that what they'll do is that they'll check them all. And there's a problem there, because there's several problems there. One of the problems is, to check them, you have to warm them up to room temperature. And when you do that, you boil all the helium. But helium, they don't have enough space to put all the helium if they took the whole ring and they warmed it all up. They have to actually put it into trucks and then drive the trucks away and then drive them back and then load it in. So they're building more capacity for that. But it's also true that helium is now expensive, whereas it used to be cheap. And there's a story there, too, which is kind of a sad political story. But so there's an issue with the helium. It makes it difficult to fix the whole ring at once. But it's also true that once you warm up, the ring is divided into octants, which have to be warmed up and cooled down together. And when you take an octant of the ring and you warm it up, it takes months and months to cool it down again. So there'd be a very long delay to do the whole ring. So what they had to do is they had to decide, what's the best strategy, the most efficient way to move forward and to ultimately fix all these things, but without completely disrupting the science program, given that this thing has been in the building for 20, 30 years. So what they did is they found that once they knew what the problem was, they could detect if it's there by measuring the resistance between the magnets. And it's not a lot of resistance. If it's at room temperature, it's something like 50 microohms, but you can measure that. But the problem is that many of these things have not been warmed up from liquid helium temperatures. And at liquid helium temperatures, that resistance is not 50 microohms. It's something much smaller. It's nanoohms, I think it is. And so that can also be measured, but you have to really be sure that you're measuring, that your correlation between what you measure as the resistance is giving you a good inference as to how bad the welds were. So what they did is, this is a cartoon of all the octants. And the ones that are red were ones that were warmed up to room temperature and they dealt with things. And then the blue ones are ones that were only taken to liquid nitrogen temperatures, which is 80 degrees Celsius or Kelvin.
And so some of them you see were never taken to room temperature. But what they did is this one was they measured the resistance both when it was warmer and when it was colder. And they could calibrate the resistance at the cold temperature by comparing it to what the same resistance was when it was warmer. And then what they did is that in the ones that broke, they knew what the resistances were that were dangerous. And they used this calibration to figure out how bad the problems were in these ones that they never warmed up. And so the plan was that they're going to they're running now without having fixed these ones that they never warmed up. But because of that, they're not running it at the full energy, because the more energy you have, the more power you'd be having to dissipate, and the more like, your tolerance and how bad the resistance can be gets worse. So they've been running at 70 eV, so it's 7,000 GeV per beam, or sorry, total, so 3.5 GeV per beam, so they collide with 70 eV in the center mass. Whereas the design was twice that. So they were originally supposed to have 7 TeV in each beam, which would be giving you 14 TeV in the center mass. And so they're going to do that until sometime in 2012. And then they're going to shut it down, and they're going to fix the rest of it. And then they're going to turn it on again at the full energy at that point. And the reason that they've timed it this way is that they think that there's something, they can understand something about the standard model Higgs particle, which I'll tell you about in a second, in that year. What they're finding is that it's working really, really well. They're getting many more collisions now than they had expected to be getting at this time. And so they think now that they're going to be able to say something interesting scientifically in this before they shut it down and to fix it. Then they'll fix it, and then they'll turn it on again. And that's why in this, I was telling you that in the next year you should be hearing something. It's what they're hoping to see or not see will be to do with the standard model Higgs, which I'll tell you about in a second. So then they've been running for some time. This is the joke is that they've been setting new records, and this one was the most people in the control room. But it was I think this was the one where they actually passed Fermilab, which was the previous accelerator that had the highest energy to that point. And so they and it's working really well. They're really happy with how it's going. So now the detectors. I got a chance to visit these detectors when I was there on sabbatical a couple years ago. And they're very impressive to see, mostly because they're just so incredibly huge and complex. And so the joke I like to tell here is that I saw the most important machine at CERN, which is the coffee machine in the cafeteria. Very good coffee, turns out. And the second most important machine, which is these detectors. This is the Atlas detector before it was finished. The beam actually goes through this hole in the middle here. Sometimes you see pictures of the Atlas detector with all the magnets in it, and people are standing in the middle of it. That's when it was at a very early stage of construction. That would all be behind this big gold shield here. And so what's happened is that there's a whole bunch of other things that have gone on the end now, and the beam pipe now goes through, and so you can't see anywhere near as much anymore. But what you can see to see the scale is that's a person on the other side. That's the legs, and that's the head. And so what doesn't come across because you're standing right next to it is that that's the four-story building that you're looking at there. It's a really huge thing in a cavernous building. And so this section I want to get across, why is it such a big, complicated detector? Why couldn't they have made it simpler? And so in these general-purpose detectors like Atlas and CMS, they're built around the beam pipe, and the collision happens right in the middle of them. And they're designed to be hermetic in the sense that they're supposed to see collisions going in all directions except the ones that go along the beam pipe. In a typical collision, what happens is that protons are made of smaller particles, and when they collide, it's like colliding two garbage cans against each other. Mostly you get a whole bunch of garbage that goes in the same direction as they came in. But every once in a while, something scatters off to the sides, and it's those things that they're looking for, because they can't really detect. There's so much stuff going down the beam pipe that they would actually destroy the detector if they tried to really see it all. So they're trying to see the things that come out, but if you have to think about what's coming out, because what they're expecting to happen is that, you might have thought that what they should be seeing coming out is what was in the proton to start with, and that's actually not quite what happens, because what happens in these, once you get to energies like they have here, and that actually have been around for decades, is that when you collide particles together, you have enough energy to produce other particles and their antiparticles essentially from nothing, that you'll something inside the proton, like a quark, will hit another quark, say, and it'll produce a photon. And then the photon will pair-produce something else that wasn't in the proton to start with. And so you essentially can produce all particles that are there that you can possibly produce that didn't have to be in the proton to start with when you make these things. But the problem is all these exotic particles that you're producing, including the ones we haven't seen yet, typically they decay very quickly. They decay in 10 to the minus 23 seconds. And so even if they're moving at close to the speed of light, they cross a nucleus before they decay. So you'll never see the particles themselves coming out. What you'll see is what they decay into. And what they're decaying into is just run-of-the-mill garden variety particles like electrons and protons and ions and things like that. And so what their goal is with these detectors is to see those particles, the ordinary particles that came out, and they want to very precisely tell you, you know, what direction those particles went, what their energies were, which particle was it? Was it a photon or was it a proton or was it a pion or whatever? And then they hope to be able to reconstruct what it came from by very carefully catching everything that's going in all directions. And so that kind of governs the way they design this thing. So the cartoon version of it is that here's the collision happens in here. So what they do is they take advantage of the fact that ordinary particles interact differently with materials. And so, and more or less, the two things that count are how heavy you are. When a particle moves through a material, it interacts with the atoms that are there, but it mostly is losing energy by hitting the electrons. So if you hit the electron with something with another electron, then they scatter. There's a big recoil of the electron that was in the atom as it gets hit by the electron that was coming from the outside. But if you hit it with something really, really heavy, like a proton or something, then the proton will knock the electron out, but it doesn't really do much to the proton. And so the protons will typically penetrate farther into a material without losing energy than an electron will, say. A similar thing happens with photons. Photons come in and they scatter from the electrons, and because the photon is not very heavy, it also can lose energy more efficiently. If particles scatter, take part in the nuclear interactions, like electrons don't, say, but protons do, then they have another way of scattering. They can scatter from the nuclei of the atoms. And so by building the detector out of different stuff, you can differentiate particles that interact through nuclear interactions from the ones that interact only through electromagnetic interactions, and you can tell which ones are heavier than which. And so what they do is they have what they call calorimeters in the middle here, the orange and the green things. The green thing is something which will typically stop something that interacts electromagnetically, like a photon and electron, but it won't stop a proton or a neutron, which will punch right through because they are heavier. But they will get typically stopped in this orange thing, which is made of something more dense. And so it'll then stop those things too. In the very, very middle, there's what they call a tracker, which will, if you have electric charge, it'll ionize gas, and so it'll give you little sparks, which will show you where the particle went physically. But if you're neutral, you don't see it because it doesn't ionize things. And so in the very outside part, these blue things are things that will see charged particles that get that far out, of which most particles don't, but muons, which are like heavy electrons, do. They get through the middle part because they're like electrons, but heavier. Because they're heavier, they punch through. But because they don't take part in the nuclear interactions, they don't get stopped here either. So you need these detectors farther out that catch them. And those are the big gold things I was standing next to in that picture that I showed you a couple slides ago. So the picture is that if you're, say, a photon, you don't see a track here, but then you do see a lot of energy in the green thing and nothing in the orange thing. But if you were a neutron, say, which is also electrically neutral, you also don't see a track in the middle. You see something goes right through here and leaves some energy, but it also then leaves energy here, but then doesn't get out to here. But if it was a muon, it'll leave track. You will see a track because it's electrically charged, and it leaves energy in all three of these things. And so you know that it's on all the way out. If it's a cosmic ray, you know, we're being bombarded by muons from space. They come in, but they hit the outside first before the inside, and so they don't count those ones. Or if it's they also don't come in when the collisions are happening. The collisions, the particles, the protons in the accelerator come in bunches. And so the collisions only happen at specific times, and they typically don't look at the detector at times that are not when the collision happened. And so there's various ways they have of picking apart the things that came from the collisions and the different kinds of particles that came out and the energy that they had. And that kind of thing. The cosmic rays go, yeah, they're very penetrating.
And if you go to the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which is much deeper than this is, they still get cosmic rays there. Much less, because that's why they have experiments down there. But the experiments that are particularly sensitive to cosmic rays will typically be very deep. But they even see cosmic rays coming from the other side of the Earth. Yeah. Because there's one of the particles I didn't talk about was neutrinos. And you don't even see them in these detectors. And they will go right through the Earth. And they sometimes interact in the rock below the detector in the bottom of a mine. And then you see upcoming cosmic rays sometimes. So the cosmic rays you can kind of get rid of to a certain point, but you're stuck with them at some level. So here's a picture of just an event. So they have all these you know, the World Wide Web was invented to help deal with the analyzing these detectors, because a lot of information is coming out. The collisions are happening so fast that they can't record all the information, and so they wanted to have a very easy way for people
in different institutions to connect into the data. And that was, they invented the HTML language, which is what the World Wide Web was based on, to make that easy. And so here's a picture, a typical event readout. So you see that these various things are telling you which parts of the detector fired in which way and which way the energy was going. And they're trying to make it as easy as possible to visually see the kinds of particles that are involved. So when you're trying to analyze what happened, you can kind of have as much to, you don't have to dig through the numbers. It's just really kind of graphically telling you what happened. So that's the machine. It's the accelerator, detectors, and so why do you care? Why did they build this thing? So the big picture is it's reductionism, right? It's we're trying to understand the properties of nature in terms of the things that things are built out of, and how they interact. And there's a, in some circles, reductionism has a bad name, right? That people talk about reductionism in a way that discredits it at some level. And so the picture is that, you know, we're trying to understand nature, and the smallest things that we know about are quarks and gluons that are inside protons, say an electron. And we don't know what's smaller than them. We know that they're not, whatever it is that's smaller than, if there is anything inside a quark or a gluon or an electron, it has to be smaller than about 10 to the minus 17 or 18 centimeters. But we don't know for sure that there's anything there, and so one of the rationales is to look. But before, I want to deal with the reductionism thing, because it's not a scientific debate. The issue about is reductionism good or bad is one of those things that, you know, it's for opinion pages and newspapers. It's not really a scientific issue. The straw man that's raised is, if you wanted to understand sheep, it's really a stupid way to do it is to think about what the quarks and gluons are doing. And that's true. And no one's saying that that's not true. But if you are trying to understand sheep, it's often true that you need to know about their hormones. You know, so part of the explanation of how they behave will be behavioral. Part of it will be to do with the chemistry in their bodies. And the chemistry in their bodies will be partly to do with the chemicals that are there, and that'll be partly to do with the things that they can do and they can't do. And that's partly controlled by, you know, the size of an atom. And that's partly controlled by the atoms have a size which is set by the properties of the electron and the proton. And those properties are in turn determined by what they're made of. And so there is a part of an explanation at high distances or at long distances, which depends on what was going on at small distances. It's not the whole story by any stretch, but it is a part. And so this is the spirit of this research is in understanding that part. So what's going on at smaller and smaller scales. So first let me, the three pieces of the standard model I'm going to tell you about is what, you know, what it is, what it's, you know, why we think it's working so well, and then why we think it's going to fail. That's the main part here. So these are, as far as we know, these are all the particles that have been seen. All the particles that have actually been seen in detectors have been things like pions and protons. But our understanding is that those are built out of these things. And this is the complete list of things that have been seen that are elementary in the sense that we don't see any substructure to them. And they break up into these different colors. All the things that we normally see in nature in this first column, the up and down quark, when you bring them together, make up protons and neutrons. So protons would be two up quarks and a down, and a neutron would be two down quarks and an up. And so in almost everything we know in nature is made of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and there's the electron. This is electron neutrino, which you see sometimes in radioactive decays, or you don't see it typically, but it's around. And every second, you know, if you take a square centimeter like this, every second 10 billion neutrinos are passing through that square centimeter being sent to us from the sun, because of the nuclear reactions in the sun. And those nuclear reactions are basically converting down quarks into up quarks, or neutrons into protons, which amounts to being hydrogen and helium. And in every reaction that does that, they produce a neutrino. And there's a lot of them just because there's a lot of things going on in the sun. And they've been detected, and we know they're there. And the fact that you don't know, you don't feel them, is because they interact so weakly. These other guys are like the first column, but they're just heavier. And so as far as they're just three copies of the same thing, and no one has a clue as to why there's three of them, nothing in nature would essentially change if you didn't have those guys, or very few things would change in everyday life. But they all seem to be there. So for some reason, nature has given us three copies of everything. The question as to why that's true is called the who ordered this problem. And so it was by Rabi, I think, was the guy who coined that. And then these four particles here, there's really not four here. There's really three here, and then there's really eight that are being called the gluon here. Those are what are called bosons. And they are those are also just particles, but they mediate the forces that we understand are driving the interactions of all the other particles. And so The photon is the thing that describes electromagnetic interactions that you're happy with. The W and the Z describe the weak interactions, which are to do with the radioactive decays and things like the nuclear reactions that drive the sun, where helium is made from hydrogen. That involves this particular force. And these gluons are the things that mediate the strong force, and those are the things that hold the nucleus together, and they hold the quarks inside a proton and a neutron. And what's not there is graviton, because that's not part of the standard model, but if you kind of added general relativity to this, then you'd have all the forces. Yeah.
There isn't a fourth generation?
Oh, with this constraint on, we don't know for sure there isn't one, but if there were one, then you can ask how it would change the successes of the standard model. So you'd make predictions based on the standard model with three generations and compare it to what you see, and then you could ask what would happen if there had been four.
So there's constraints on how low their mass could be?
Basically, yeah, and how strongly they can interact with things. And So it's, right now I would say that it's there's a parameter space where you could have had four generations, but they have to have very special properties. But it, you know, 20 years ago, people really thought a lot very hard about it because at that point the constraints were quite weak, and it was a very natural question to ask. And in the intervening 20 years, the bounds have gotten better and better.
So where would the graviton fit in here? If they actually found
and look for it. You just have to stick it on the page somewhere. It's not there's no organic connection. It's just another force, and it interacts in a way that we think we understand, but it's really, logically, they're very separate. So.
Oh, but the real problem is what's the symbol, because G is taken.
G is taken. that's the problem. People would use H often, but...
H?
Yeah, and I think it's because the gravity waves are normally, the metric is normally G, but the fluctuations in the metric, which are gravity waves, are often written as H.
Really?
I think because it's the next letter.
Yeah, and then
it's a deep reason like that.
So who goes first?
So the standard model actually has one more particle, and I didn't write it first because it has never been seen. So one of the things you'd like, if the standard model is true, this particle has to be there. And so one of the things that the LHC hopes to do is to see if this particle is there or not. And when I told you that they will have something interesting in this next year, the interesting thing they will have is they will know if that particle is there or not. They'll either detect it and tell you some of its properties, or they won't detect it, but they'll know that it was not there to be detected. So the standard model Higgs has very specific, the theory tells you exactly what its properties are, and so you know what it should look like. And so if you fail, experimentalists distinguish between failing to see something and seeing nothing. And what they will do is see nothing. They won't fail to see it if it's there. So they'll know one way or another if the Higgs is there in the next year. So that's the announcement you'll hear about, I'm sure, because that'll be a big press thing. So the Higgs should be there. So I should first tell you, you know, why do people believe the Higgs should be there? I mean, what's wrong with the standard model without the Higgs? And the problem is mass. That if you the history of it was the standard model was essentially written down. The people who got the Nobel Prize for it were Sheldon Glashow, Steven Weinberg, and Abdus-Salam. And the Glashow part of it happened in the early 60s, and the Weinberg-Salam part of it happened in the late 60s. And what happened in between was people figured out how particles get mass. And the problem is that if you take the particles that we've seen, which they hadn't seen then, but if you take the particles that we now know are there, and ask what their masses would be, there's the theory has a symmetry which says they all have zero mass. They should all move at the speed of light. They should just be like photons as far as the reasons are. But of course, we know that that's not true. The electron has a mass. Other particles have masses. And so the revolution that happened between the early 60s and the late 60s was people figured out how to understand where mass comes from for these particles. And the way to think about it is that, and it's a very deep statement, and it's one of those things it's deep, but it happened so long ago that people forget how deep it is. And so if you read a graduate student textbook in the standard model, it's very rarely do people make a big deal out of this, but it's really a big deal. And so the statement is that basically the idea that they discovered was that the symmetry that's forbidding mass is a symmetry of the equations of motion, of the laws of nature. So it's like if you think about, you know, Newton's laws, when you write F equals ma, F and a are vectors, and m is a scalar, and you care because that's saying that the laws of nature are rotationally invariant. And the fact that those vector equals vector says that the law of nature that you get that way will be the same for anybody, regardless of whether or not they use a rotated reference frame or not. And that's what vectors are good for. But just because the laws of nature, like F equals ma, have a symmetry, doesn't mean the solutions will have a symmetry. You know, there are certainly things described by Newton's laws that are not rotation invariant, you know, like you. You know, you can't rotate you in all directions and you don't look the same.
And so there's a distinction between the properties, the symmetries of the solutions of the equations and the equations themselves. And so what people recognized was that the inference that particles had to be massless based on the symmetry that the standard model would like to have is only really true if the solutions describing those particles have the symmetry. It's not sufficient to know that the standard model has the symmetry. And in particular, the key part of it is the vacuum itself. The particles we describe are you're talking about one particle moving through the vacuum, but the vacuum can have physical properties. And so you should think of the vacuum as being like water. And it's actually very a good analogy for the issue of mass, because if you imagine moving through water, what you would mean by mass is you'd push something, and you'd see how much acceleration you get for that push, and that would be telling you what the mass is using Newton's law. And so if you imagine looking at water, different things move through water with different amounts of resistance. And so those would be things that would be interpreted as having different masses, because the same push on a fish and on a gorilla would not give you the same motion. And so you'd infer that the gorilla was more massive. So the basic observation people made was that the vacuum can have physical properties. It can be like water. And when what you measure as mass for particles is the motion of, it's the response of the motion of those particles through that vacuum. And so that's an incredibly deep statement, and they're trying to test it. And so testing the standard model and the Higgs is trying to test that statement. So the thing that you're moving through is called the Higgs field in the standard model. But the Higgs particle is a wave in that field. And so with relativity, you know that if you have any kind of a property in the vacuum, since nothing can go faster than light, if I change the vacuum here, if I heat it up, or if I do something like I put it underwater, the news that I've done it has to travel at most at the speed of light elsewhere. So it has to be possible to have waves in this thing. If you perturb the vacuum here, the news that something's changed will move throughout the room at some speed. And the thing, that wave, is the Higgs particle, or quanta of that wave are the Higgs particle. And so you're really taking seriously the idea that the vacuum has physical properties. It's like the ether in many ways, which normally you poo-poo, but it's you poo-poo it because the ether was violated the way it was originally proposed. If it was literally water, there would be a preferred frame, and the speed with which water waves travel would be different to you if you're moving through the water at different speeds. But the difference is between the Higgs particle and the ether is that the Higgs particle is a Lorentz invariant vacuum. It's a vacuum. It's a physical vacuum which satisfies the properties of special relativity. So you can move at different speeds through this Higgs vacuum and not violate anything that special relativity would have told you. But it can still give you a mass. And that was kind of the reconciling those two things was more or less the hard part. It took them a couple of years in the 60s. But that's the picture, is that the vacuum has properties, and you should really take it seriously. You ding the vacuum, it'll have wiggles, and those wiggles will be particles, and you want to see them. It's also true that if you heat the vacuum up, its properties could change. It really is like water in that sense. It has a physical, you can have different phases of it. You know, if you cool water, you can make ice, or you heat it, you can make steam. And in the standard model, if you heat the vacuum, it can change to a new vacuum for which everything does move at the speed of light. And that's believed to have happened in the past, in the early universe, but it's just not happening now. It would be a bummer if it happened. And so one thing you would worry about, the story of the Earth being destroyed, part of the things you would worry about is could the LHC cause this transition to happen? And the answer we think is no. But we've done the experiment now, so it's all good. But that's the idea, that you had to have the vacuum have properties to give things masses, and if it has that property, there has to be a particle that tells you. That's a manifestation of the fact that the vacuum had physical properties. And it may not be that if the standard model is right, those properties will be specific. And so the waves in the vacuum will have specific properties. But if it's not the standard model, there still has to be something describing what the vacuum's doing. And so there'll be something else that'll play the role of the Higgs. And the LHC will have to see one of those two things. Is your hand up?
Yeah. I'm so interested. You're saying, I think, the Higgs theory, or this theory, is that all vacuums would have a Higgs field. The properties of that field could be different depending upon whether it's heated up. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so it's like...
But there wouldn't be vacuums without a Higgs field.
Well, the Higgs field could be zero. So that would be... So it's like... It's a way to think of it is something like an electric field. If you had charges in the vacuum...
So you could have a vacuum without a Higgs field.
There could be, and that would be the one where we all move at the speed of light.
Okay.
And so the thinking would be if you've actually heated the standard model vacuum high enough, then that would be the one you get, is the one where the Higgs field is zero. And so then there's no resistance, and that's why everyone has
it. And is it proper to use the language of the Higgs field being the medium of this spectrum, or is that not
yeah.
a good language?
I mean, the people don't use that language, but I think because medium has this loaded notion that it's going to be
yeah.
like the ether, and it's going to break the special theory.
Okay.
So that's why people don't use that.
I understand.
But I think there's nothing wrong with it, apart from that, as long as you have that stuff, right? All right, so that's the standard model basically, and that's why there's this missing thing, which really has to be there, and it'd be really cool to find it. Be really cool in many ways. As a theorist, it's actually the least cool thing if you find the Higgs, because that theory has been invented, and so there's nothing to do at some level. But that's not very likely for reasons you'll see in a second. So the next section is so why do we believe it's true? And so what I really want to get across here is that the success of this theory is not just, you know, it looks kind of cool, it probably should work. It's really quantitative, and it's like you hear about the tests of electromagnetism where you measure the Lamb shift of the atom, and it's compared a theory to experiment to 10 decimal places, and it's not quite that good, but it's almost that good. It's 5 decimal places, but it's a very quantitative comparison, and that comparison tells you a lot about this Higgs particle, even though it hasn't been discovered, and that's kind of why people are confident they'll see it if it's there. So here's an example of a prediction in an experiment, or many experiments that are compared to it. This is showing you this is a plot of the cross section, or it's the probability of a reaction where you take an electron and a positron, which is the antiparticle of the electron, and you collide them together head-on, and you look at what comes out. And in this case, the thing they're looking at coming out is hadrons, which is just anything that's strongly interacting. So it could be protons, neutrons, ions, whatever. But not, say, just electrons. There has to be something strongly interacting. And so the black curve is what the Standard Model predicts as a function of the energy of the collision. And so it kind of goes down, and it goes up again, and it goes down again. And the reason they've got a Z here, or a Z here, is that there's a big resonance here where the rate for the interaction goes way up because this energy is exactly the energy of the mass, corresponding to the mass of the Z boson, which is one of the things in the Standard Model. And these different colored dots are experiments that have done the measurement, and you see that they really hug the curve really well. And these ones, the red ones in particular, were done in this experiment called LEP. And LEP was actually an experiment that was in the same tunnel that the LHC is in, but it was the tunnel was actually dug for this earlier experiment in the 80s. Called the Large Electron Positron Collider or something. And so that didn't need superconducting magnets because electrons are lighter, so you don't have to steer them quite so steeply to get them in the same circle. And it was lower energy. So anyway, the message here is that the theory agrees with the experiment very well. And this thing here is just the same reaction, but now that instead of looking for hadrons, they look for W pairs. So they look for a reaction where you get the W plus and the W minus coming out rather than something else. And again, those experiments were done at LEP. They agree very well, too. So there's really a good agreement over a very wide range of energies. And this slide is busy, but it's just mostly showing you the kind of level of agreement. So here's a whole bunch of things you can measure in those experiments. And it doesn't really make much difference what they are, but this is the mass of the Z boson. This is the decay lifetime of the Z boson. These are what they measure them to be in those experiments. And this is what the theory predicts it to be. This is a fit to the theory. And the fit is relying on essentially 3 or 4 parameters. Almost. Now, I should say that there's really a bunch of masses, and then there's 3 or 4 things describing the interactions. But you see there's many more things being measured than there are parameters, and the fact that it's working so well, the bar graph is showing you how many standard deviations there is between the theory and the experiment in units of the error of the experiment. And so you see that there's the worst case scenario is that there's a 3 sigma deviation between theory and experiment. And in 20 observables, there should be a 3 sigma deviation, because that's 1 in 20 is 3 sigma. It's like 98% it's 95% confidence level. So it's basically an extremely good agreement between theory and experiment, and it shows you that it's kind of an accuracy of better than a percent. You know, it's a part per thousand or something like that. And in particular, what I want to show you here is how this is constraining properties of the Higgs boson. So this is a graph of a log scale. So this is 100, and this is 1,000 in units of GeV, which is basically the energy and the rest mass of a proton. And this is the mass of the Higgs boson, and this is the mass of the W boson. What's plotted here is that the yellow band is the measurement of the W boson mass. And so it's some value plus or minus something, again in GeV. And this curve here is the theoretical prediction. In the Standard Model, you get to predict that if you know the W mass, you can predict the Higgs mass and vice versa. And so that's why this is not a vertical line, is that there's a correlation between the value of the Higgs mass and the W mass in the Standard Model. And this is kind of the theoretical error in the prediction. And this shows you that they can agree, but they can only agree if the Higgs mass is fairly light, where fairly light means, you know, 100 or maybe depends on how
if this, I can't remember how many sigma this is, but I think if you allowed yourself a couple sigma, you could get up to here. So less than 200 GeV, let's say, is what you would get from this, that the Higgs has to be light. So that means that if you're looking for it, you know where you're looking. It's not, someone can't say, oh, well, but you haven't seen it, but it's just because it's so incredibly heavy that you haven't got to it yet. It's the accuracy with which it's been tested tells you how heavy this Higgs particle can be. Not completely, but it gives you a range. And it has to be a light range, which is the one that you have access to. All right, so that's all good. So what's bad about the standard model? So in the last 20 years, there are some experimental things that don't fit in the standard model. And so that's certainly bad, because the thing about particle physics, when we were talking about the particle physics movie that the PI is making, at one point we're talking to a researcher who said, we had a debate about whether or not when you solve various problems that I'm going to talk about here, will it be a particle physics solution? And that's crazy. That's like saying, is it a physics solution? For a particle physicist, whatever the solution is, we're going to call that particle physics. You know, because particle physics is a theory of everything. And if you find something that doesn't fit in, then that means the particle physics was wrong, and the new particle physics includes it. And just like physics, you can't have a non-particle physics solution to these problems. And so the problems are that the standard model, there's two of them, basically. The standard model predicts, the first one that kind of came in, depending on your count, is that the neutrinos in the standard model, there were three. The standard model has a conservation law that says that these three things essentially are massless. And the Higgs vacuum doesn't change that. The standard model says that the Higgs particle has no resistance, the neutrinos have no resistance in the vacuum, and they should be massless. And there's basically been experiments done now that show them to be consistent to having a mass, so they're excluding that they're massless. And the experiments, there's more than one type of them, which is partly why you believe them. But the first ones came by looking from these neutrinos, these 10 billion neutrinos that are coming from the sun. And the prediction of the standard model is that you should only be seeing one of the three types of neutrinos, because there's a conservation law that says there's only one being produced in the reaction of the sun, so that's what you see. And that's what people look for. And for decades, it's been known that they were short. They were always finding kind of half to a third of what they should be seeing. And nobody believed that they'd done it right, because more or less the first experiments, what they would do is to see a neutrino, they'd get a ton of cleaning fluid. And they'd put it in a mine, and it was cleaning fluid is more or less chlorine for the experimentalists. And every once in a while, a neutrino would go through. It very rarely interacts with anything, but if you give enough stuff, it'll eventually interact with something. And so a neutrino would convert a chlorine atom to an argon atom and an electron. And so then what they would do is every 3 months, they'd flush the tank, they'd count the argon atoms, and they'd get six. And then, but it was six plus or minus two, so it wasn't one, and it wasn't 10. It was six plus or minus two, and everyone said, you really think you can count atoms that well, and didn't believe them. And then other experiments did the same measurement, and they agreed. So then they said, well, do you really believe you understand the sun that well? That there's just fewer neutrinos coming from the sun. And so there was a long process where all those various things were removed, and it culminated with this neutrino experiment in Sudbury, in Ontario, in this nickel mine, where they actually measured for the first time all three types of neutrinos and saw that the ones that people were looking for were low, but the other ones were there, and they were there in just exactly the amount that would add up. If you added them all together, that was the amount people had thought would be coming from the sun. And that was the clincher. And then to really clinch it, they did the same experiment with slightly less accuracy, where they didn't use the sun as a source, but they used an accelerator which produced neutrinos as a source, and they saw the same kind of thing happening there. And so that really, over the years, has really convinced people that these neutrinos are not behaving the way the standard model says. And there's another class of experiments to do with cosmic rays coming down through the Earth and through from the sky, which is a similar kind of a story that points to neutrinos having masses. The second thing is that in cosmology, people have finally done a survey of the energy content of the universe, which they can do because general relativity relates that to the curvature of space, basically. And by looking at by measuring how much matter is in different regions of the universe, but using gravity only as the measurement tool, so inferring how much mass is present by how things orbit around that mass rather than by what you see, they've been able to identify that what you see is mostly not atoms. And so the breakdown of what's in the universe is everything we know about in the standard model is 4% of what's there. And the interesting thing is how you know that, because even if you're not seeing it, it's not atoms. There's an argument for that. But the rest of it is two other kinds of things. It's not just one other kind of thing. It's two kinds of things. And they, for lack of other things, have been called dark matter and dark energy. And you're inferring their existence through gravity, so it's not completely clear whether you're seeing that gravity is not working the way you think it is, or you might be seeing some other kind of particles. But whatever you're seeing, it's not the standard model plus general relativity. And so there's something wrong here, and that's got to be fixed. And I would say my personal take on this, which in this building you may not get from everybody, but my personal take would be that the evidence for dark matter and dark energy involves the convergence of many, many types of things. The reason people believed atoms existed 100 years ago before they actually saw them was that there was many, many ways of inferring their properties, and they all gave you the same answer, regardless of how you thought about it. And when you modify gravity, there's no example of a theory that does that, that captures all the evidence for dark matter and dark energy. Whereas if you think of a new kind of a particle, there's lots of theories. It's very easy to write theories that capture all the evidence. And so regardless of what your tastes are, I think the preponderance of evidence is that you're looking at a different kind of a particle. And the kinds of particles you need are not particularly different from the kinds of particles we have. The only thing you have to do to modify an ordinary particle we know about to make it dark matter, for instance, is to make it not decay. So it would be around still from the early universe. As soon as you do that, then you've got lots of dark matter. The abundance that you would predict is essentially what people see. So there's lots of give and take as to what's going on. But whatever's going on, it's not the standard model. I'm thinking now of the standard model, including general relativity. So those things are really something wrong. What's bad about those things is that those things need not be solved at the LHC. If dark matter is particles, then it's very likely that the properties that they would need make them very likely to also be produced at the LHC. And so then there might be some interplay between what the LHC would see and what we know about dark matter. But it doesn't have to happen. So it could be that the resolution of what dark matter is or dark energy is won't tell us what's going on at the LHC, or there may not be any implications for the LHC. So although this is really the take to the bank sign that the standard model is wrong, it's not really something specifically you have to be able to look for at the LHC, although the dark matter is plausible that you could look for it. So there are theoretical problems, and those are the ones that are more imperative for the energies that the LHC can reach. And so the one I'm going to focus on here is the hierarchy problem. And that's the one that really drives these three categories of theories that I told you everybody more or less is working within. So the remainder of the talk, which is already a little bit late, is to just tell you the problem, tell you the three, just briefly what the three proposals are, and then that'll be it. So what's the hierarchy problem? The hierarchy problem is basically the question of why gravity is so weak. If you kind of look at the various scales in physics, the ones involving in particle physics are all very similar to each other. The basic scale of the strong interactions is similar to the proton mass. The basic scale in the weak interactions is similar to the W boson mass, and they're a factor of 80 between the two. So they're different, but they're not so different. The scale of gravity seems very different. If you make a mass out of the Newton's constant, that's called the Planck mass, combining it with H bar and C in the right way to get a mass out of it, or an energy, the energy you get is 10 to the 17 or 16, depending on how you count, times bigger than all the other scales we know about in physics, in particle physics. And so there's a huge difference between the scale to which gravity points and the scale to which everything else points. And so that makes, and high energy is small distances in quantum mechanics. So that means that there's probably something at very small distances. We know that classical description of gravity fails at very small distances, but it's an extremely small distance because gravity is such a weak force, is what this is saying. And your physical intuition as to gravity being weak is another way of saying gravity is weak. If you want to know what the evidence is for gravity being weak, the evidence is astrophysical objects are large. And the reason they're large is that the sun, for instance, is built by the competition between gravity making things want to compress and nuclear reactions wanting to, the energy being pumped out is balancing that. And you just need a lot of stuff to have gravity compete with nuclear reactions. And that's why stars are so much bigger than you are, say. You're smaller because you're more or less electromagnetic interactions balancing amongst themselves. But gravity is not involved in that. And that's why non-gravitational things can be small. But gravitational things tend to be enormous because gravity is so weak. So the question is, and quantitatively, the mass of the sun turns out to be this Planck mass that we're getting here, cubed divided by the proton mass squared. If you kind of work with that balancing issue and ask what it would mean, that's kind of more or less what it means, and that's basically the right answer. So the question that's driving this hierarchy problem is trying to understand why gravity is so weak. And you might say, I don't know, why should we know? And so there's a sense in which this is an urgent question, and that's the thing that's kind of hard to get across. And so the best I can do is give it an analogy. So I've been telling you that the vacuum is like a fluid, or it's like some physical thing. And so it should have phases. And so there's a way of phrasing this hierarchy problem in terms of that. So imagine that we're talking about water again, and this is the phase diagram of water, where this is pressure in a log scale, and this is temperature on a regular scale. And this is where it's a gas, and this is where it's a solid, and there's different kinds of ice. So, and this is where it's a liquid. And so I can never remember where atmospheric pressure is, but it must be something about, you know, so room, so 100 degrees Celsius would be 373, so that must be around there. So that must be about atmospheric pressure. So that's basically where water is boiling, and that's where ice is freezing for us at that pressure. And if you go, the interesting thing is if you make the pressure high enough, you can go from liquid to gas without ever having any latent heat, so you never get any boiling if you go past this critical point. But that critical point, this line here is the coexistence curve between liquid and gas, and it ends at some spot. And that's a very characteristic spot. If someone told you the properties of water molecules, you could predict where that spot is, because you'd say that the energy is, you know, what's happening between liquid and the gas is you're moving the molecules away from each other, there's a force involved. How much energy do I need? And you can figure out what the temperature you'd need to get that energy from collisions, and that would more or less tell you where this thing was. And so the temperature where this happens and the pressure where this happens is something which is calculable in terms of the basic physics that's involved, you know, the energies of the forces between water molecules. So if somebody told you that they'd done this measurement and that critical point was way down here at zero temperature, essentially, you'd be surprised, because that would mean that it's costing you no energy, whereas the basic physics seems like it should cost you a lot of energy. And so what's going on in the standard model is like that, in the sense that we know that the physics of whatever the real physics that, you know, that once we've figured all out, whatever that is, that's going to include gravity. It involves a very, very high energy scale. And but there is some sort of interesting vacuum physics going on, which we're seeing in the standard model. But that's at an extremely low energy scale compared to the high energy scales that is the basic physics of the problem. And so we're in a situation in the standard model that we do have a phase transition which is extremely small. It happens at very low temperatures in units of the basic physics that we think is describing nature, which is the highest scales that we know about are the ones that involve gravity. And so there is a problem like this, that we have a very low scale. And in condensed matter physics, there are some examples of theories where you do have phase transitions at very low temperatures. And those are the condensed matter physicists love those systems, because there's something interesting going on there that explains why. Those are called quantum phase transitions as opposed to ordinary temperature-driven ones. And they love them because there has to be a reason why nothing was happening at higher energies and everything got driven down to low energies. And so we have a similar situation in particle physics, that we have an unusually low scale associated with a vacuum, and there has to be something explaining why that's true. So that may not have been very convincing, but it's kind of like in a superconductor. Superconducting temperatures are extremely small. You know, the LHC has to be cooled down to a few degrees Kelvin. But the electrons involved are the same electrons that are giving you current. And so the typical energies and temperatures associated with electron physics are normally much higher than, more like room temperature or higher. It's kind of very unusual that superconductors have to be, you could ask, why do superconductors have to be made that cool to superconduct? And that actually was a long-standing problem in condensed matter physics, which was resolved when they understood that there was a very, very feeble force involved. But it needed the main thing is that it needed an explanation, and so in particle physics we have a situation like that. We've got something happening in the vacuum, which is at a very low scale, which needs an explanation, and the explanation has to kick in essentially at the energies that we have access to with the LHC. So what can you hope to see? One option you could say, well, the worst case scenario would be nothing, and so this next slide or two is showing you that won't happen. That the Higgs, if it's there, you'll either know it's there or not there, but you'll know. Actually, before I get to that, the first thing you say, what happens if there's no Higgs at all? Could that have worked? Why didn't Weinberg and Salam and Sklashow write that theory down if they didn't have the Higgs? There's a very concrete way of seeing why the standard model has to fail, or where the standard model has to fail if there's no Higgs. And this is an argument of principle, nothing to do with what you measure. And so the argument is that if you look at something like W particles scattering from W particles into more W particles, that's something which can happen in the standard model, as a function of the energy of the scattering, then in terms of the standard model, that takes place through the exchange of a photon. These are supposed to be, these big lines are Ws, and they could exchange a photon, they can exchange a Z. They have a direct contact interaction that they can have. And if with the particles we've seen, that would be what dominates. And if you ask how likely this collision would be as a function of energy, it turns out to go like the logarithm of energy. With just those particles. But there's a general feature of quantum mechanics that says that probabilities can't have to fall with energy like 1 over e squared. Because if that weren't true, then the sum of probabilities would have to actually, some probabilities have to be bigger than 1. And that's something which can't happen. And it's not like it's a detailed thing. It's a very, very general property of probabilities. That it's the uncertainty principle in action, essentially saying that if you go down to very high energies at very small distances, and you're limited by the size of the thing that you're hitting at some point. And so this can't be the right answer. Something has to be going wrong. And where it fails to be the right answer is where this starts to be bigger than 1 over energy squared, which happens when the energy is of the order of the W mass divided by alpha. Alpha is the fine structure constant. It's 1 over 137. MW was 80 GeV. So this has to happen at kind of 1,000 GeV or so. That's where the LHC was designed to look. That's why it was designed to look there. Something has to happen here. You can't afford to have no Higgs there. In the standard model, what happens? The standard model, if it's sensible, shouldn't do this, and it doesn't do this, and it doesn't do that because there's also a Higgs exchange that happens, and that cancels this logarithm and gives you something which does the reasonable thing. So this is, shows you that there has to be something. You can't not find the Higgs, and you can't find, not find anything else. Or if you do find nothing else, then we learn something really interesting because there's something very, very bizarre going on with how W scatter. Could you see the Higgs boson? It's the next few slides are supposed to convince you that you can, and it's probably not so important to see in detail why. The main message of these slides is that whether you see the, to decide if you've seen the Higgs particle, since the Higgs particle is decaying so quickly, depends on what it decays into. But what it decays into depends on how heavy it is, because it can't decay into something that's lighter than it is. But the Higgs particle, the intuition you should have about Higgs particles is that they're the wave in this vacuum that's giving everybody mass. So the bigger mass you have, the more strongly you are coupling to the vacuum, and so the more strongly you couple to the Higgs particle in particular. So the Higgs particle would love to decay into the heaviest thing that it can decay into, because those are the things that couple to it the strongest. But you can't decay into something that's heavier than you are without violating energy conservation. So it always decays into the heaviest thing that's lighter than it is. And that changes if you imagine dialing its mass, the thing it'll decay into will depend on what mass you chose. So this is showing you that. This is showing you the fraction of times the Higgs decays into something. So one is, it goes there all the time. 10 to the minus 1 is it goes there one time in 10 and one time in 100 and so on. And this is a function of the mass of the Higgs. It shows you that for light masses, where light means lighter than about 115 or 120 GeV, the Higgs likes to go into a bottom and an anti-bottom quark almost all the time. That's because it's very heavy. It's the heaviest thing below the Higgs. But eventually what happens is that it becomes more likely to decay into W pairs because the W is heavier than in the bottom quark, and eventually, and this place here is more or less defined by twice the W mass. So once the mass of the Higgs is bigger than twice the W mass, it can decay into two W particles, and so then it does. So that says that if you're looking for the Higgs that's heavy, you look for W decays. If you're looking for it light, you look for bottom quark decays, and so on. So now this next slide is showing you how well they can see those various things. So this is showing you the significance of what they see in sigma. So this is 5 sigma. That's the thing where they actually say they've discovered something. And this is a function of the mass of the Higgs, and the different colors are the different reactions. So the thing decaying into W's was the purple thing, so that's what we're using here. The blue thing is the Higgs decaying into W's, where one of the W's decays into something else very quickly. And then the bottom quark is this blue one here, so that's what they use when it's very, very light. And basically the envelope of these things is this, and so that shows you that they believe that no matter what it decays into, they can see it at better than 5 standard deviations. So that's telling you that they've designed the machine to see this thing, and if they hadn't, then you should have fired them all because they had 20 years to get it right, and they think that they've done it. So that's why they're virtually certain that they're going to know one way or another in the next year because they know exactly what they're looking for. So what about beyond the standard model? I mean, it would be kind of the standard model can't in itself be right because of neutrinos and other things. So what are the proposals that have been made to deal with the hierarchy problem? The 3 proposals are I'm just setting you up for that. There's 3 proposals. So what are the 3 proposals? So the 3 proposals are, the historically conservative proposal is that you find that things that we think are elementary now are made of something else. So there's the compositeness conjecture. And in particular, if the Higgs particle itself is made of something else, that would go a long ways to understanding this question as to why the vacuum has properties that are very, very low energies compared to the other scales in physics. That's actually what happens in superconductors. The superconductor, the analog of the Higgs in a superconductor is called a Cooper pair. It's 2 electrons that are bound to each other by a very feeble force. And the reason that that's such a light thing is that the force is feeble, but it was made of something that was actually not a, you know, the electrons, it was made of something smaller. The electrons themselves were things that made up the Cooper pair. So this is the proposal that's like condensed matter physics. It's just things are made of smaller things. The second proposal is, this is just telling you it's conservative, would you believe? The second proposal is what's called supersymmetry. It says that if there were a symmetry that related bosons and fermions, which are the particles that satisfy the Pauli exclusion principle are the fermions, and the ones that don't are the bosons, those are the ones that mediated forces. If for every particle of one type, you had a particle of the other type, which you did not have in the standard model, there were only four bosons and a lot of fermions, then it turns out that you could understand why this this transition scale would be so small. But it would only work if for every particle there was a partner which had very specific properties, the same charge, the same mass, or very close to the same mass. And so it's very much like in the old days, if you imagine people predicting antiparticles. The antiparticles, every particle we know now has an antiparticle, which has exactly the same mass, exactly the opposite charge. That was a case where people didn't, but they could have, in principle, theoretically, predicted that every particle you see should have a partner. And this is in the same spirit as that, that there's a, if there are new particles with just the right properties, then you would understand why there could be such a difference between the gravity scale and the other scales in nature. So that means that everything in the standard model that you know and love, all these things, has a partner which you has very specific properties, so you know what to look for. And so they're looking for them, and the short version is that they're not finding them. They already would have seen them for some range of masses by now. And so this is something which is not ruled out, but it's something which is, it's people are starting to scratch their heads a little bit about it. The people that, this is the most popular option, I think, amongst theorists, I think, in particle physics. Various reasons it's popular is that this is an example where if you look at the W mass as a function of the top quark mass, again, there's a, those should be correlated in the standard model. And the measurement is in this circle here. And the standard model theoretical prediction is this strip here, which is not really statistically significantly different. But the supersymmetric models would predict this. And so it likes to agree better. And so although you can't say that the experiments have chosen one or the other at the level of statistical significance you believe, people, you know, they read the tea leaves a little bit and they say that actually looks better in a supersymmetric case. And there's other things that supersymmetry does, like makes forces unify and things which would be nice. But it's not something that you have to believe. It's just something which is a suggestive. Now, the third option is the one that took, the first two options were basically invented as soon as the people knew there was a problem back in the early 80s. The third option was something which only came in the 90s. And that's the realization that the gravity scale that we're talking about is not a particle mass. It's the size of a force. And that could be just misleading us. Maybe what we're really asking is why gravity is weak. And we're thinking that it would be weak if there were particles that were very heavy whose exchange was describing gravity. But that may not be the way it works. It could be that if gravity could be weak for some other reason, then you wouldn't need to have heavy particles. And the realization that came kind of late in the day was that that could actually happen if you had extra dimensions. So more than just that way, and that way, if you had other ones, gravity could leak into the extra dimensions, and that would be the why it's weak. And then you wouldn't need it. It could then be that quantum gravity could happen right there at the LHC. And then there's nothing to explain then, because all the scales are the same. So that's kind of the outside-the-box option. But essentially, those are the three options. More or less, they're mutually, they're not mutually exclusive, but they pretty much cover everything that's been proposed. And so let me just cut to the chase here. This last one is the one that leads to black holes, because gravity is strong in the LHC. And so the good news is that they're right, that black holes will be produced. Where they're wrong is that they're just not going to eat the Earth, is the thing. They'll just evaporate through Hawking radiation right away. And there's lots of reasons why people might believe that, which you're probably prepared to see. There's lots of great websites, which I steer you towards, where they show movies of the black hole eating the Earth. This is France here. This is the black hole eating France, and it continues on and eats the whole world. And there's a really great soundtrack going on the whole time. So you should see that, because it's much more entertaining than the CERN sites that deal with this. The CERN has a site about if you Google, has the Large Hadron Collider destroyed the world yet? Then the top one that you're sent to is a CERN page which says this. Some people have more time on their hands than others. And the interesting thing here is if you kind of go to the page source and look at the HTML code, there's a little thing on the bottom which says if the LHC actually destroys the Earth and this page is not yet updated, then please email mike@frantic.org. So I'm sorry I'm running really late, so I'll just summarize. Summarize is the LHC is on, it's running, it's working like a charm now, it's not quite at full energies, but it will become at full energies. And this is the kind of thing which, it's very rare that you see a scientific revolution coming, but this is one of those times, because this is an experimentally driven field where all the evidence is that there's something wrong happening at the energy that they're looking. And so this is what you technically call science. And so you should be watching the papers, because there will, on the short term, be some statement about the Higgs. But the exciting thing will really be they're most likely going to find something completely different from the Higgs, probably one of those three options. But any of those three options would be fantastically different. And so it would be extremely exciting. If they do see the Higgs, and only the Higgs, That's boring for me, but it's a very deep statement about the vacuum. And so we will have learned something very, there would have been a prediction made about the vacuum properties back in the 60s, which will have now have been tested. And it'll be, it is a very, very far reaching statement about what the vacuum does. And so that would be cool, even if that's all that happens. But I think most people would bet that what they're going to see is a surprise. And every time you make a machine that sees further, you typically get surprised. Not always, but most of the time you do. And so that's a great hope. So sorry for running so late, and thanks for your time. They probably won't have these slides on the web, because last time we found that the first slide that says it's going to fucking kill you dead gets censored at the PI site.
But I think we got around it.
You got around it here, or you took it somewhere else?
No. Actually, they did make it available to the teachers. I suspect it was only to the teachers here. It wasn't available to the general public. But there's also the holy shit. Right?
There's the holy shit, yeah.
And that was big letters.
But that's so far into the thing that they never noticed. What they flag.
We'll make sure it's available for this group anyway.
I don't know how you want to do questions. It's been late, and so you might want to go for lunch.
Actually, can you go to lunch with us?
Yeah, I will certainly do that. I'm happy to ask a question now and then.
There we go. Okay, so how about we're supposed to be back here in an hour, so you're going to eat lunch downstairs, and don't all swarm Cliff at once. And do make sure...